Well, we discussed earlier resistance testing, particularly in the treatment-naive patient, but should patients who were already on antiretroviral therapy have resistance testing?
It's very important to be able to do a resistance test when, as David said, you discover that a patient persistently has a detectable amount of virus. Resistance comes about for a number of different reasons. First of all, as David said, this virus is amazingly clever at surviving no matter what. And when people take their medications erratically, and they wind up for a period having low levels of the drug in their blood, then the virus, which is fairly sloppy as it reproduces itself, automatically is creating mutations all the time. Perhaps one of those mutations relates to the low level of that particular drug. And when the virus figures out that that mutation is useful for survival, then more and more the virus will switch, and that will become the dominant virus in that person's body. There are other elements that come up, too. The patient may have resistance that you don't know of, and therefore the drug doesn't work. And sometimes there's a pharmacokinetic problem, that the drug is not being fully absorbed. For example, let's say it's a drug that requires an acid environment for absorption, and unbeknownst to you, the patient is taking over-the-counter proton pump inhibitor medication. And then the acid environment, of course, is reversed by that medication, and the medication just isn't being absorbed.
You know, and timing of resistance is very important as well. We use resistance testing after first, second, third failures to be able to specify which the best medications are to use. We oftentimes use resistance tests during acute infection if we are planning to treat the patient as well. We use resistance tests in pregnant women who are HIV positive so that we know which kind of virus they have so we can use specific regimens that will block that virus from being transmitted to their offspring.
Well, another one of the physicians we met with had a question for our panel about antiretroviral therapy.
Can people stop and start antiretroviral treatment and still do okay?
The answer to that is very simple. No, no, and no. We've done any number of studies over the last 5 years looking at interruption of therapy, and they all turn out to be not good for the patient. Now, sometimes you can't avoid that because a patient will stop taking his or her medication because they aren't feeling well, and then that's something you have to cope with. But in terms of a strategy of treatment, of saying to the patient, stop treatment and we'll restart at some defined point later, the answer is no, that's not good for people.
And I think, you know, what the studies that Judy's referring to, the big one called the SMART trial, really showed was that treating HIV infection is not just about T cells, not just about recovering T cells. It's in large part also about suppressing the virus and keeping it suppressed over a long period of time.
I would agree definitely with Judy. The answer is no. And we still have patients that do that. And we try and help them understand that's not something they should do. If they need to have the therapy changed, we can change it if they're having side effects or toxicities. But they shouldn't just stop.
Well, that's really part of the challenge, isn't it? When should a physician consider changing the antiretroviral regimen?
Well, there's two reasons to change in my mind, two kind of making it simple. One is for virologic failure. If indeed you're taking the medications, your virus is going up, you do a resistance test and you find that nilfenavir, let's say, an old regimen, is no longer working because of a mutation, then of course you change the regimen to three drugs that your genotype or your phenotype tells you the virus is sensitive to. So that's the simple one. The other time is when you listen to your patient and you hear them say again, I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't live with the diarrhea. My workplace only allows me 2 bathroom breaks in 8 hours and I can't embarrass myself, so I can't take a medicine that causes diarrhea. So if you give them a drug that causes this diarrhea, you need to change that.
Absolutely.
Well, as we've discussed, treatment failure can be an obstacle in the management of HIV/AIDS. And we met with a patient of Dr. Hardy's, John Duran, in West Hollywood, California, who helps to illustrate this very issue.
This is election night here in West Hollywood when I got reelected.
My name is John Duran, and I'm an attorney and also the mayor of the city of West Hollywood. Being the mayor of West Hollywood, it's sort of like telling people I'm the Wizard of Oz. West Hollywood's one of these incredible places in Southern California. We're the home of the Sunset Strip, and we're the home of the gay and lesbian community, and we're the home of movie production studios. And so it's this little snapshot of, I think, the ideal Los Angeles lifestyle. I'm one of four HIV-positive elected officials in the United States. There are two in California and two in New York.
Oh, God, now I'll blush.
Okay. In 1994, I just one morning woke up and I was feeling very drained and I was having difficulty breathing. I was hospitalized initially with pneumonia. I was testing HIV negative for a week. They had these blood samples of me on a day-to-day basis and they got to analyze that blood and watch somebody go from negative to positive. When I first got diagnosed, the doctors prescribed AZT. That was really the common treatment or therapy at the time. I was on AZT for just about a year or so before they started introducing new drugs to me. And early in the course of my treatment, as I was taking different drugs, the virus would keep adapting to the medications that were coming at it. My doctors would change my prescription whenever it looked like things were going south. I was a really tough case. They kept throwing new drugs at me, and then the virus would mutate around the drug. And so for a while there, we were sort of constantly changing drugs. And each time, it would cause the virus to dip a bit, but then the virus would come back stronger. I was a good patient. Whatever the doctor would tell me to do in terms of medication and pills, I was compliant. I had pretty much dealt with the fact that I was going to die very soon, and then to suddenly be told, nope, not yet, you're being raised from the dead. As I understand, treatment failure just means that everything's not working. It either means moving to a whole new class of drugs if you have them available, or remixing the antivirals. It's not like it used to be where if you failed the drug, it was off the table indefinitely. Now it's possible to bring some of these drugs back in new combinations with new classes of drugs to have another go at it. I had to take a 6-month leave of absence from my law practice and go on disability for a period of 6 months while we shifted drugs. That was a really important period of 6 months because it reminded me again, you know, what's important. I've been non-detectable for over 2 years. I started an entry inhibitor. It interrupts the reproduction of the virus at a different stage. It actually prevents the virus from initially attaching to a healthy T cell and inserting its RNA. I take 24 pills a day, and I inject myself twice a day. I still have HIV. I can still transmit HIV. It just, today, it doesn't have the upper hand. My immune system has the upper hand. I am 48 years old. I'm going to my 30-year high school reunion next month. I'm healthier than people who maybe haven't faced a life-threatening illness.
That's like a heat-seeking ray for me.
I think I'll see 50, and I think I'll see 60, and I think I'll even see 70.
John Duran's an amazing man. He really is. I feel very lucky to be able to be his healthcare practitioner and a partner in his healthcare. He demonstrates, I think, for many of us, what I would call the HIV treatment learning curve, in that he, when he first became positive, he actually got very sick. He was one of those rare cases who actually got pneumocystis pneumonia during seroconversion. He had a severe decline in his CD4 cell count, had to be hospitalized during seroconversion, had pneumocystis, and almost died at the first time he got infected. Interestingly, he's been on almost every HIV medication known to man. I call it the learning curve because medications were thrown at him basically one after the other as it became available from 1992 on, and he has become highly resistant to those most of our medications because of that. Fortunately, he was able to enter into a clinical trial with a now licensed, although then investigational medication that has really turned his life around.
And his statement that he expects to live to be 70 is very possible in this day and age. As long as we continue to have this pipeline and have new classes of drugs and have people as dedicated as he is to doing the best he can to take them, and we have clinical protocols going on, it's very possible that we can continue to extend people's lives like this.
But even you know that obviously multi-drug-resistant HIV infection is a big issue.
Yes.
So what are some of the options that you can offer these patients?
You know, I think this is a very exciting time in HIV therapeutics because our ability to put together regimens for these multi-class resistant patients is really starting to turn the corner. No longer are we going to have to reshuffle old drugs, trying to piece together partially active medications on our resistance testing to try to hope that we'll be able to give them something that might work or might not, as holding our breath the whole time as they take them, but that these brand new classes with no pre-existing resistance are really going to show that we can put together very effective, tolerable regimens that patients can take for a long period of time.
The goal of therapy in those patients a few years ago was just to help them hang on to the T cells that they had, hopefully get a few new T cells, and sort of keep them out of the hospital. So now that we have new drugs in older classes that are much more active against resistant virus, as well as totally new targets, which, as David says, means the patient cannot possibly have resistance to these drugs because they have their body hasn't and their virus hasn't seen it yet. The Public Health Service recommendation is, even in these patients with highly resistant virus, to aim for complete suppression, to aim for a viral load that's undetectable.
Well, Dr. Sweet, I think you had mentioned previously some of the side effects that come along with these medications. What are some of the major side effects that patients face?
We have seen with these drugs, all of them now, metabolic effects, long-term metabolic effects, where their cholesterol goes up, their good cholesterol, HDL, goes down, their triglycerides can reach remarkable heights. Diabetes is developing in some of our long-term survivors. It seems to be a class effect associated with the protease inhibitors. So that you kind of have to separate what it is you can really work around, the early side effects, along with those things, the metabolic effects that are going to happen in some people, and then you have to treat them.
Patient adherence is another issue that has come up in our discussion today, and it's obviously very important to the success of antiretroviral therapy. We met with one of Dr. Sweet's patients, Cindy, in Wichita, Kansas, who struggles sometimes with taking her medications.
I was first diagnosed in April of 86. With HIV. I didn't tell nobody that I had HIV for 7 years. I was waiting for the right time, and the right time never comes.
She came to us in 1989, and she was quite healthy, really. She, at that point, was not on any medications, but knew that she was positive. When we started Cindy's medication, she was having more problems. Her CD4 count had dropped. It was important at that point to see what we could do to bring them back up.
I first had problems keeping up with the regimen when the protease inhibitors came out, and they were very hard to keep up with. You had to take it 2 hours before you ate and 1 hour after. What made it so difficult was just finding the time, you know, because you would eat at different times. You had to make sure you ate at the same time every day. Having children made it very hard because you get involved with them and you forget.
Good morning.
I'm raising my 2 grandchildren.
Wow.
I'm changing diapers and running kids to the Y. The main reason that it was difficult for me to take my medicine, I believe, was the combination of being busy and the way you had to take it.
Cindy's non-adherence is very much similar to just about all of my patients. They mean well, they intend well. It's not hard to miss medications when you're supposed to be taking so many different ones, and you take them at this point 2 or 3 times a day. Once you have your adherence to less than 95%, it's a vicious kind of animal in the sense that it can learn to work around those low levels of medication.
I realize if you don't take your medicine right, that the virus mutates. The regimens are much easier now. You only have to take generally 1 to 2 pills versus 8 pills.
We always try and adjust the medication regimen so they take it less often in the day. For Cindy's future health, the outlook is wonderful right now. She has over 350 CD4 cells. She has an undetectable virus. She is able to take this medication successfully.
The way HIV has affected my life is that it made me get my priorities straight. I feel really lucky that I'm still alive and able to do everything I can.
Well, Cindy's a wonderful example of someone who has tried hard for 20 years, and she, over the years, has always taken care of somebody else and not her. That last statement she made, where she's finally come to grips with the fact that if she doesn't take care of herself, she won't be there to take care of those kids. So she's a very good example of how many of our patients really want to do well. But these are tough drugs, and they have been really tough drugs. It's getting easier, but you can see now with the regimen she's on, she's still getting a handful of pills. She's never going to be that one pill, once a day kind of person because she has so many mutations. But eventually, if you just keep pulling with people, they oftentimes will come to that sort of reasoning that they had better change or they won't be with us much longer.
What are some strategies to help patients adhere to these medications?
I think probably first and foremost is getting to know that patient as well as you possibly can, understanding their life stressors, understanding the chaos or lack thereof in their life, whether or not they have any social support, how many kids they're trying to take care of, what their job situation is like. We ask our patients to do things that I'm not too sure I could honestly do without a significant change in my lifestyle. So getting to know the patient, trying to understand their challenges, and then figuring out ways to partner with them to help.
One of the other things that it's really crucial to understand is that we really have no notion of how to predict who is going to be successful at taking their medications and who isn't. We've done lots of studies about this, and there are no positive predictors. Doesn't matter what gender you are, what race you are, what ethnicity, how much education you've had, how much money you earn. None of these things predicts who will be good at taking medication. We do know from those studies that there are two situations that are bad for adherence, that have an adverse effect on adherence, and that is continued drug or alcohol use and the presence of depression. And luckily, counseling and the use of antidepressant drugs can help manage that very successfully.
You know, that's where the art of HIV medicine comes in, of really hearing your patients, understanding what's going on in their lives, and seeing how they can work their regimens into their lives and still have a life.
We have had a great discussion today, rich, full of depth. What are the main take-home points that you would want our viewers to know?
I think first and foremost, having people remember that this disease is not gone, it's not over. We have that 1.2 million people infected. We see 49,000 new infections every year. The prevalence is going up. There's more in your community right now than there has been ever before. So that prevention messages are important. Along with that, screening really is important. We need to get the 300,000 people in this country who don't know that they have it tested. Everyone deserves a test so that everyone between 13 and 64, per the CDC recommendations, gets an HIV test.
I would like to make sure that the audience really understands that HIV is now a manageable, treatable, chronic disease. We have many, many options now for treatment, and treatment clearly works.
This disease has always been handicapped and plagued by stigma, and it's time for that stigma to be put to bed. This is something that physicians, again, as leaders, can really have a big impact on by demonstrating to their patients that HIV is just another disease like so many other that we deal with day in, day out, and that screening for it and getting people into care is a very simple and important thing to do.
Well, in closing, I'd like to thank each of you for joining us in this important conversation about HIV and AIDS. And I'd also like to thank our viewers, and I hope the information presented today will help you to improve the management of your patients. Also, be sure to log on to your computer at discoveryhealthcme.com and take the post test. It's a quick way to earn free CME credit just for watching the program. And if you'd like to review the program, you can watch it online, download a podcast, or order a free DVD. In addition, all the slides and references from this program are available on the website. Finally, I'd like to thank the University of Virginia for accrediting the program. Also, thank you to the American Academy of HIV Medicine for their collaboration and assistance in putting this program together. And of course, we'd like to thank Bristol-Myers Squibb for the educational grant that made the program possible. For Discovery Health, I'm Rhea Blakey. We'll see you next time on Discovery Health CME.